Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-1166, Denali. Federal Star 8, Petitioner versus Federal Investigative Commission. Issue number 1, the state threat evaluation petition to Petitioner Ms. Jones for the respondent to themselves and for the intervener to Mrs. Black.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Randy Jones, and I represent a number of diverse petitioners, large and small producers on the North Slope, and shippers on taps, the state of Alaska with its own interest that's been recognized by this court, and the past and present owners of the refineries along taps. I think this case on the resid valuation, as we are here once again, represents looking at two issues, the end result, which the commission says they don't have to do, and also substantial evidence supporting the result. In this case, I would submit the substantial evidence does not support what the commission did. Hope Natural Gas 320 U.S. at 602 addresses the standard. Under the statutory standard of just and reasonable, it is the result reached and not the method employed which is controlling, or stated differently, it is not the theory but the impact of the rate order which counts. In this case, that wasn't done. This test was reiterated in Duquesne Light by the Supreme Court in 1989 on the second point. They basically say you first look at the end result to see what that is, and that determines if you have to go further and look at the components that were used. In this case, what happened?
Is there any case which we have many cases which hold that FERC can approve a formula as just and reasonable, correct?
They state that it can approve formulas.
Is there any case which says that that approves or where we've approved a formula yet gone on to say that FERC erred by not calculating the end result of the formula?
I don't think you've actually looked at it that way. I think what the case
well,
isn't
is... Isn't that your point?
My point is, but if you look at it, the point is, as I think what the cases have said, they don't have to come out with a specific number. In other words, the actual rate number isn't what you have to look at. It's the rate formula. In this case, what we're looking at is the formula that goes and sets up what the ultimate numbers will be of the resid value. The resid value changes every month, as it does every other cut on the TAPS quality bank, because they use different published prices. But what you have to make sure is that the way it's set up results in a just and reasonable valuation for the resid cut that goes into the equation that sets up the overall quality bank adjustment. And that's the difference in the cases, and the point we're making is why you have to look at the end result, because it then tells you if you have to go look at the components. The commission states they just have to look at the components and find that they're just and reasonable or that they work. In this case, they don't work because of the components and what they plugged in. It's obvious that the ALJ, what he was trying to do, and it's that he went in and he said, I can adjust Mr. Jenkins' cost curves. I can increase them by adding some stuff to it. But I cannot adjust the ExxonMobil Tesoro, which I'll refer to as EMT, detailed design. I can't adjust it down. There's no way for me to do that. So it's clear what he thought he was doing was moving the value of the resid from, if you would, like the left-hand side or left goalpost, $4.30 from the eight parties, moving it up, but under the EMT 697 on the West Coast. The problem is, if you analogize it to a goalpost for a field goal, he never kicked the ball. Had he kicked it, he would have found out he suffered the same fate as Bobby Bowden in several national championships, wide right. His number was 747. The commission then came in and handled the coke handling, added it on, and when they didn't kick the ball, but had they would have found out it was $8.36 approximately, or about $1.40 higher than ExxonMobil, which means the resid value was about $1.40 lower than any party in the proceeding proposed. The problem stems primarily from the commission taking the $35.1 million co-handling costs from Exhibit PAI 10.
I wonder if that makes inherent error that it's lower than anybody proposed.
Well, Your Honor,
if you're correct in that calculation, does that in and of itself entitle you to the result you're praying?
Well, I believe it does from the standpoint, Your Honor, if you look at the record, there's no testimony from any witness, expert or any other witness, stating that the lower resid value established by the commission is just and reasonable. All they rely on is footnote 481, which I think is Joint Appendix 1391. The ALJ said, I read the whole record, I'm satisfied, it's just and reasonable. And this is even going back in time for a retroactive adjustment. Nothing is pointed to, no evidence is pointed to, and that's why it gets back to, I think, what the Supreme Court said. You have to look at the end result up front, and if it's not just and reasonable, you can then go look at the components and see what the problem is. But I would agree with you, Your Honor, but that does, in and of itself, in this case, warrant it being remanded.
Yeah, well, you're not agreeing with me. I ask a question.
Well, I understand, but I understand with the question you asked. But looking further, PAI 10, there's double counting. You've seen us use about double counting. I want to talk about it in just a couple minutes because it's important to understand. First of all, on PAI 10, Mr. O'Brien disavowed it being able to be used. He said you can't add stuff to a cost curve. Professor Gary from EMT stated the same thing. A cost curve is an overall cost for a processing unit, but you can't go extract out the individual component cost, and you can't add them in. Furthermore, Professor Gary also said something's wrong with that number in PAI 10 because it's no coke handling cost would be that large a percentage of the coker cost. In this case, it was 21% of his and 33% Mr. O'Brien's. Even EMT.
So, I'm confused about your argument about these coke handling costs. Is your argument that what the ALJ added in, this pit and the crane, right?
Yes, sir. He said they needed to be added.
Okay. You're not challenging that, right? You're challenging the failure to deduct the front loader and the platform or something?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the problems in the cost curve.
That's your point, right?
That's our point. Plus, Mr. O'Brien also. I'm sorry.
So what is a front loader cost?
There is nothing in the record on the front loader. There's nothing in the record on what a pad costs. That's not in the record.
But you want us to remand this case because he didn't deduct the front loader and the pad?
No, Your Honor, it's more than that because also Mr. O'Brien testified that he had included some of the refineries that were included in his cost curve had pit and cranes. He also made the point that other parts of the coke handling are outside the battery limits, and he put them in OSBL. Because coke just doesn't sit right next to the coker. It has to move, and it's treated usually elsewhere. And so he split the cost. What happened is the commission put $35.1 million of coke handling cost into the ISBL. And when they did that was a West Coast number, but they put it into a Gulf Coast number. When you use the location factor that was ordered 1.27, that becomes $48.8 million. That number is also
would you just focus on the double accounting of this? Where is the evidence that there's double counting of these coke handling costs?
This is part of the double counting, Your Honor. It is on the fact that they're using a West Coast price and a Gulf Coast, and then using the location factor again to move it to the West Coast. It's doubled up that number by 27%. In addition, that number is used. The ISBL number is used for fixed costs. There's 8.25% multiplied by the SBL number, and that carries over into the West Coast. In addition, to move his number from 1996 to 2000, there's a 1.073 adjustment, and there's also the 35% OSBL number where was not adjusted, and I'll deal with on the storage tanks in a minute. It wasn't adjusted to reflect that some of that material, Mr. O'Brien said, was in his 35% OSBL. The net effect of all of these multipliers is for every dollar of that $35.1 million that went into the ISBL, it's $1.77 on the West Coast. So you have, without taking out and putting in dollars on top, the double counting spreads throughout, and that addition is basically what moved the commission's cost deduction factor from 747 of the ALJ to 836, almost 90 cents per barrel lower value of the resid, simply from using that number, an inappropriate number to be used. Even Mr. Jenkins from EMT said it was only guesswork at best that we're in those numbers. And that's the problem. There is no evidence substantiating the use of that PAI 10 number as it was used in this case, and the use of it is what results in the resid value being much lower than anyone proposed in the proceeding. The other thing that the commission said, we're not adjusting the OSBL number because they're storage tanks. And it's not $30 million, it wasn't $34 million. That's what Mr. Jenkins started with for EMT. But actually during cross-examination, he dropped it to $20.5 million on the Gulf Coast because of economies of scale. But then he had also referred to nine different refineries he used to substantiate what he did. We got the permits, we went through them, cross-examined him on them. It's Exhibit WAP 97, it's Joint Appendix 1701 and 1702. When you look in there, you find out for these refineries that put in a coker, they either, the ones that we could identify, added one new tank or refurbished existing tanks because they had to do something with the resid already. In addition, he used 15 days for storage. The average for those refineries was 5.5. Using his dollar per barrel for storage costs came out to $5.8 million for a tank, certainly more than enough in the OSBL.
I want to be sure that I understand the arguments in this case. There's a great many of them, and I may miss one here. Is it the case that the commission included an element of shipping and handling for coke, but not for other people?
Yes, and I'm going to, that was just where I was going to, Your Honor, is
you
because
I... a little bit of time to get
yes,
to your answer.
And on the coke, first of all, the important factor to understand is fuel gas in coke and the other products are treated differently. Fuel gas was stipulated to the parties as an avoided cost because the fuel gas from the coker is then used as fuel in the refinery. So the appropriate way to value that was to look at the cost of natural gas plus the transportation to the refinery. That was the total cost you were avoiding, and that was what the parties stipulated to. All the other components, including the coke, have to be shipped and handled from the refinery to the delivery point. Regardless, they all have cost. And so what's all that's been done is saying we're going to single out one here and not apply the shipping and handling cost to it, but we're going to still not make adjustments for any of the other cuts. Again, we think that's inconsistent. I think it's inconsistent with this court's Oxy decision because that, on the face of it, is
but
putting...
In Oxy, we said that the commission made a mistake by ignoring processing costs for one cut when those costs were far higher than for others. Isn't that exactly what the commission did here?
That's what they did.
Well,
they ignored.
That's what Oxy says the commission is supposed to do.
Well, no, they took out a cost here for only one of the cuts, made an adjustment for a cost.
That's what Oxy says they're supposed to. We criticize the commission and Oxy for not treating cuts differently because of different processing costs.
Oxy hurts
you.
I think Oxy actually says it's consistency among the cuts. There, if you needed to...
Am I wrong that we rejected what FERC did there because they had ignored processing costs for one cut when they were much higher than for other cuts?
It's where they use finished product price.
No.
Yes, sir.
Didn't we say that?
They had to use to get to an intermediate product
didn't we
price
say,
processing
didn't we say
cost.
In Oxy that FERC had erred by treating all processing costs the same when they were, in fact, different for some cuts?
I think it was treating not applying processing costs where they were required to get the intermediate feedstock price. You couldn't use the finished product price, and you had to look at each one, but you were to treat them on a consistent basis because some of the products had a published price and no processing cost was required in the quality bank. And so here they're selecting one of the items to remove a cost, but not doing it for the others, even though they all bear the same cost. If my I was just going to touch very quickly on the assays.
Okay, you got about 44 seconds left.
Okay, on the assays, that it did is correct. As the commission said, we did propose in the brief on exceptions using 4 of the 5. However, the commission never addressed the exception, and they refer back to the initial decision. There, we said it was wrong to use 2 of the 5. In addition, with respect to the CCR table, if you look at the actual table, it's there. EMT's own witness said there was a significant variation. We submit that there should only be the 3 agreed to assays. Finally, I just want to note the final test was in the second part of the issues, and that's where you compare the cooker feedstock valuation from the commission's deal with the fuel oil blending, and you can see that there you would not build the coker.
Okay, thank you, Captain.
You thank you, Your Honor.
Elapsed, and now we'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pacella for FERC. Never had to lower this before. Thank you. The ALJ in the extensive hearing was presented with 2 different proposals for how to value resid. And what he found was that he was troubled in part by the way O'Brien's cost curve did it, but he was more troubled by the way that Jenkins' detailed estimate was done. And so he found that he could modify Jenkins' estimate in certain ways, modify O'Brien's cost curve estimate in certain ways by adding the items that specifically were left out, and then he would feel that the cost curve should be used because that would result in a just and reasonable resid value. His explanation is very clear on the record. I mean, he had 2 proposals before him, and he did the best that he could with those 2. Then he found that the resid value that would result would be just and reasonable. The commission affirmed that. The commission, after looking at all the issues raised on exceptions at J 1343, paragraph 49, said, "We affirm that the ALJ's resid value is based on a just and reasonable methodology, and the resulting value is just and reasonable." So with this formula rate.
Well, the petitioner says the commission couldn't have known the latter part of that because they never added up what the ultimate value was.
Well, with a formula rate, you don't have to do that, as I believe Your Honor was pointing out. Yeah. What you look at is the specific parts of the methodology, and if you find that each part of the methodology is appropriate, then that is going to result in a just and reasonable value. And that's what the commission found here. The commission spent a lot of time looking at each of these components. There's nothing that they didn't consider in this case.
Could you just focus on the double counting allegation with respect to these coke handling equipment?
Sure, Your Honor.
Am I right that their argument is that when he added in the crane and the pit, he didn't subtract out the...
Exactly. It's that limited argument.
Okay. So what's the answer to that?
The answer is that that's true, that the commission didn't subtract it out, and that the commission...
Was there any evidence that these places need both?
That apparently is the commission's view.
Where is that in the record?
Well, the commission talks about that.
Where?
It doesn't talk about that specifically. It just says... At JA 1338, paragraph 36, and JA 1459, paragraph 36 are the 2 places that the commission addresses this issue.
Yeah, but does it in there say that there's evidence that suggests that refineries need both front loaders and cranes?
The commission doesn't say that. It does specifically say that it intends that the estimate will be supplemented by the additional items, and not. It doesn't mention that the coke pad and front loader would be deducted, and that apparently is
so
because
your point is the commission used the word supplement, so it knew what it was doing.
It knew what it was doing.
That
exactly.
Must have been the case.
I'm sorry.
That must have been.
That's right. That's right. Uh-huh. I believe that Judge Santel had some questions on the coke shipping and handling.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd be happy.
It appears that FERC is allowing it, or including 100% shipping and handling on coke and 0% on everything else.
That's right.
What is the rationale for that?
The commission's rationale, again, came from the ALJ, which the commission affirmed. What he said was, if you look at the RSID formula, what everyone's agreed, stipulated in this case, that RSID will be, it's going to be the before cost value of COCA products. So he said there are three things that make Coke unique here. First is that it's a solid, not a liquid or gas, and so it can only be moved by truck, rail, or solid bulk vessel. It can't be moved through pipe. And that's different than any of the other cuts. The second thing is that Coke shipping and handling costs aren't comparable in any way to the other any other Coca products. And it gives, for one example, while Coke is 4% of the common stream, its shipping and handling costs are 17.3% of the total logistics costs. But in comparison, VGO, which makes up 36% of the common stream, comprises only 31% of all of the shipping and handling costs. So that's just the second reason. And the third reason was that sometimes the price of Coke is so low, it's so valueless, that that they have to sell it at a loss because they can't keep it at the plant. They have to get rid of it. So these three things separated Coke out from every other product. And
what is it used for?
It's used, well, it's basically the RSID of Coca products.
If someone buys it, what do they use it for?
They use it to, that's a good question. I'm wondering if I read anything about that. I'm not sure, Your Honor. But basically it's
useful in metallurgy like coke to coal?
You know, I just don't know. But it's very valueless.
Maybe no one else does either. Maybe
I'm sure someone else in this courtroom certainly knows more about Coke as a product than
maybe,
I do.
Maybe that's why it has to be sold at a loss. No one else knows what it's good for either.
Buy it on speculation.
Right.
So
they will find it.
So the commission had a very good substantial evidence basis to find that this was so unique that it had to be, in order to value, truly value it, as the ALJ explained it, J683, paragraph 1174, in these circumstances, if I'm to truly determine the value of Coke, that I have to consider certain refinery costs regarding this cut, this product.
I can readily see how Coke has a higher adjustment as a result of shipping and handling. I'm not sure how I can see for sure. Sure, how it's logical to have 100% adjustment on Coke.
Well, the first time the issue was whether there should be an adjustment or not an adjustment. There was never a claim that there should be a partial adjustment before the commission. Okay. That wasn't raised, and so I don't know how the commission would have addressed that. Are there any other questions that the panel has on this issue? Thank you.
We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Ron Flagg for intervener ExxonMobil. Let me quickly address the Coke handling issue, and I believe Coke is used in metallurgy, Your Honor. I would urge the court to take a look at EMT 34 and EMT 35. Those are two exhibits that show that transportation and handling with respect to Coke represents 61% of the value of Coke. With respect to the other Coca products, the values are 2 to 8%. So I believe the commission acted reasonably in saying where you've got a product that where transportation and handling represents 61%, you need to make an adjustment. Where these values are 8% or less, there's no need for an adjustment. With respect to the double count, Judge Tatel, I believe the record is as follows. Mr. O'Brien not only sponsored his cost curve, but tried to demonstrate to the commission why his cost curve, which produced much lower costs than other cost curves used in the industry, and he explained that by saying those other cost curves, such as Gary and Handwerk and Myers, included certain coke handling, three different types of coke handling equipment, mm-hmm. The pit and crane, the crusher and screen, and coke storage. And he made a deduction for each of those that totaled, as Mr. Jones said, $35 million. When the commission determined that it was a mistake to have eliminated, to not have included those in his cost curve, they simply did what Mr. O'Brien did, which was to add back those amounts into the O'Brien cost curve. When Mr. O'Brien made those adjustments, he did not deduct out anything for the coke pad and front-end loader. He didn't deduct it from, you know,
and
from
so
his cost curve.
So they were in his already.
Pardon me?
They were in his already?
Yes. And so if there was a double count, he would have had to make the same adjustments.
Well, no, but if he didn't, he deducted out the cost of the crane and the pit, right?
He deducted out the crane and the pit.
Yeah, but what did he do with the front loader?
He didn't do anything. That's my point, Your Honor. If he want, if in order to be on an apples to apples.
Well, do these refineries need both?
The record, you know, I think the commission thought they did. Yeah. They used the word supplement, as did the ALJ.
So your point is, O'Brien simply deducted the higher cost items, and since that was wrong, all the commission did was put them back in.
Correct. And he didn't make, when he made his adjustment, he didn't say, "Oh, I've got to take into account that I've got to add back into those other cost curves the amount for a front end loader." He didn't bother to add that. You know, whatever the dollars would have been. So I don't think there's any evidence in the record to support the claim that there's a double count. The commission simply did the exact same thing that Mr. Jones' expert did in adjusting the cost curves to put them on an apples-to-apples basis. And when the commission determined that you needed that equipment, they simply added in the cost that Mr. O'Brien said he had deducted, and there was evidence in the record as to what the $35.1 million was. Mr. O'Brien, in his oral testimony before the commission, explained how he got those numbers. And the only other figure in the record on the costs, that was the only evidence in the record on the total costs for those three components of coke handling.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think your time was up. We'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I just would quickly respond, there was another set of numbers. Mr. Jenkins had costed out the very items he said needed to be included, and it came out to be, on the West Coast, $8.8 million. Our point was, starting with, if you were going to use something, you couldn't use PAI 10. Look at the man that said this is what you needed to have, the party. That's the number to use. The judge never relied on PAI 10. In his initial decision. And so I think that just shows in the deduction. Professor Gary said you can't do even the deduction, you can't do what Mr. O'Brien did with those numbers. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Call the next issue.
Issue 2A, constitutional issue. For the petitioner, Mr. Phillips, for the respondent, Mr. McIntosh, and for the intervener, Mr.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Carter Phillips. I represent Exxon and ConocoPhillips. I recognize I have a serious task to try to convert your attention away from separation of streams of oil to separation of powers, but I will do my best to shift your focus at least for a few minutes. It seems to me that the issue in this case is essentially the question that this Court specifically left open in the Save Our Mall decision, and the language that the court used there is that to the extent Klein can be read as saying, and Klein being United States versus Klein, the Supreme Court's decision on this issue, that Congress may not direct the outcome in a pending case without amending the substantive law, this court in that decision chose not to address that specific issue. It seems to me that is precisely the issue that is presented by what Congress has done here, because what Congress has undertaken to do is to say that retrospectively, with respect to the refunds dating backwards, They cut off the right to recovery as of February 1, 2000, even though this court decided in the earlier Exxon decision that refunds back to 1993 would be appropriate so long as the commission makes the appropriate findings with respect to any of the equitable issues that may arise. But then Congress, interestingly, did not use that same standard prospectively, so that if a refund case were filed today and the circumstances were precisely as they were presented by this case, by both Exxon and Conoco's claims in this case, it is quite clear that that rule, that the rule that applies prospectively, would not in any way bar recovery of the refunds that are being claimed by Exxon and Conoco in this particular case. And we submit to you that that is an exercise not of the legislative powers, but of the judicial power, and therefore it is beyond Congress's ability under Article 1 to act.
Mr. Phillips, what Congress is limiting is the authority of a commission rather than of an Article 3 court.
I don't believe so. I don't think the distinction can be between Article 3 and Article 1, because otherwise you'd be left with the argument that Congress would be free to modify state court decisions, would be free to modify the decisions of the Court of Federal Claims.
Ab initio to modify a state judgment decision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's a different constitutional question, state judgment decision.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there would be a federalism issue there.
Forget the state judgment decisions. I don't think any of us are going to be worried about the state courts at this moment. Let's talk about Article 1 and Article 3.
Well, if
a whole different federalism consideration.
There are federalism considerations there, but if you accept, if I could just take 2 seconds to respond to that, because I do think it's worth worrying about some, because if this court says that the only limitation on Congress's ability to exercise judicial functions is Article 1.
For a moment, we're not going to say that. We're going to talk about something that has nothing to do with the state. It's about Article 1 and Article 3.
Right, but the limits of Article 1 typically, are pretty breathtakingly sweeping, and therefore could well preempt state court determinations as well. So I don't want to give that up completely, even though I recognize you'll protect the states, and that's a laudable goal. I hope you'll protect the Article 1 courts as effectively. But the truth is, the Supreme Court has made clear that Article 1 institutions, the Court of Federal Claims now or the Court of Claims at the time, do in fact exercise judicial powers. And administrative agencies exercise precisely the same judicial powers. It seems to me the question does not turn on the label.
That elided, perhaps, the question. When you got to the Article 1 commissions or independent commissions as opposed to Article 1 courts reviewable by Article 3 courts, do you have a case where there's been a commission whose decision is affected in a fashion that invoked Plout or Klein or Hayburn?
I think the closest is probably, and again, this will be dicta to be sure, but it's Paramino Lumber, where the court was dealing with an Article 1 administrative agency. There it was a workers' compensation claim, or a longshoreman and Herbert workers' compensation claim. And the court, in holding that it was okay to intrude and to restart that particular proceeding, specifically said that here, this is a different case because Congress did not set aside a judgment, create a new right of action, or direct the entry of an award. Well, what Congress did in our case is direct the entry of an award. And so, to be sure, Paramino doesn't specifically dictate that that makes it unconstitutional. It at least makes it clear that that's a serious issue that the court has to entertain. And I submit to you with good cause, because this is a truly classic adjudicatory dispute between two private parties, that in the absence of Congress's efforts to regulate the quality bank, it's quite clear that these disputes would be resolved as a matter of contract law, and it is quite clear to me that under the circumstances as this case comes to this court, we have Exxon, Conoco, absolutely innocent, have paid more for the quality of the oil that they get at the back end of this process. Other parties have paid less, and they have used Congress to say, in a specific dispute with respect to those kinds of very specific rights, the winner now is the party that had lost in the proceedings before the agency.
Is that the difference between this case and the Save the Malls case, that this is two private parties?
I think in part it's because it's two private parties. I think
why would that make a difference?
Well, I think what really makes a difference is not the private parties part of it.
Right.
I think it is the fact that it is it's a purely retrospective assessment of the dispute between two private parties.
But the statute says any proceeding. I mean, there could be other proceedings that could be affected by this.
You mean retrospectively?
Sure.
But they had to be pending.
Right.
There were none.
Well, but...
And Congress knew that.
But in the coalition case, there was only one case. That law could only apply to that case.
Right, but it would also apply then prospectively to divest courts of the ability to use those same statutes as in a subsequent challenge to trying to prevent the mall from being used for the World War II Memorial. The same rule that was being applied prospectively...
Congress knew that the bulldozers were out there digging the hole at the time. I mean, there wasn't going to be...
Right.
A subsequent memorial. It's all over that one memorial that the issue is going to be.
Right, but that's not to say that there wouldn't be subsequent efforts to try to block the memorial from going up at the last minute for any of a number of reasons. And basically what Congress said, and I recognize, obviously, Judge Tatel, that you know, some situations lend themselves to a single solution. And Save Our Malls was one of those. But that's not true with respect to the Quality Bank, because there were other refunds. I mean, the part of this that is particularly offensive is the date that the Congress has chosen. February 1, 2000, it wasn't grabbed out of thin air.
Offensive doesn't mean it's unconstitutional.
No, but it does reflect the fundamental unfairness of it. I think it raises a more interesting equal protection issue, perhaps, than a separation of powers issue. But the point is, the Congress allocated the rights among the parties by saying, for some parties whose only claims to refund arise beginning February 1, 2000 going forward, they get protected completely. And it's that disparity in the rights that makes this appear more like an adjudicatory proceeding that Congress is interfering with than anything else. When you start picking and choosing among litigants and you say, you win, and you lose, I understand when courts do that. They do that to me all the time. I'm usually on the lose side of that. But what I don't understand is when Congress does that in
that's
a specific case without
the,
adopting that rule.
That's what they did in the Mall case, too.
It had the effect of causing a winner and a loser. But it also had the effect prospectively of saying no one can come in and raise these specific statutes as in an effort to bar this mall from going forward. So the rule applied there was being applied to the existing case and to all other litigation. I mean, it seems to me that case would be the same as this case.
But
this,
by definition, this is only retroactive, so it can't apply in the future.
But it could have applied. It would have been easy enough to say no refunds in Quality Bank litigation, period. And then you would have a rule that would have stopped us. And obviously, I would have been a loser in that situation as well. But at least in that situation, misery loves company. And candidly, it's quite unlikely that Congress would have enacted that law because all of the parties would have been objecting to it. It's when Congress sits there and starts to pick and choose and identifies one to pick off and make a decision, or in this case, two to pick off, that it seems to me Congress makes a mistake. And if this court doesn't step in here, what it does will take the concept of checks and balances and convert it into something that looks more like checks and more checks to Congress. This is a situation that strikes me as ripe for abuse.
Can I go back to your point that you were responding to Chief Judge Sentell about whether these are these administrative agencies or what type of authority they're exercising? And that is whether it's judicial or not. Is that
right?
What you said, that it's judicial?
It is judicial.
But it can't be Article III.
No, it's not Article III,
well,
Judge Tatel.
Then you don't have a separation of powers problem.
No, you do have a separation of powers, because Congress's authority under Article I is to exercise legislative power.
Right.
It doesn't have the authority to exercise judicial power.
Well, what it doesn't have is authority to exercise Article III power.
It
could abolish FERC.
Right, but that wouldn't be an exercise of judicial power. That would be an exercise of legislative power, because that's a rule.
Yeah,
it couldn't abolish it. My colleagues here on the other side would probably take offense at that, but I'll let it ride. But if it adopted that rule, it would adopt that rule prospectively too. It would eliminate all that FERC did in the past, and it would eliminate all FERC could do in the future. But it seems to me Congress can't do without exercising judicial power, whether it's Article III judicial power or not. The Supreme Court has made quite clear in cases like United States versus Williams in Freetag that there is a judicial power that is exercised by Article I institutions. And what the question that we're posing here is, can Congress go beyond its legislative powers that are the specific textual grant of authority that Congress has, and exercise judicial powers, whether exercises an Article I institution, or I realize I'm treading on some turf here, but or is exercised by a state court, or is exercised by the District of Columbia courts, for that matter. It seems to me all of those institutions are exercising judicial power that is not Article III power, but is nevertheless beyond Congress's ability to dictate a rule that applies to the specific dispute between the specific litigants involved, whether in an agency, the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, or the state of Alabama, and then choose not to take that exact same rule and apply it for all prospective litigation that may arise in other contexts. That, Judge Tatel, is the vice of this decision, of this action by Congress. And the fact that you don't see this happen very often, it seems to me not surprising. And in that sense, it seems to me it's quite like the Plout case, where the court recognized that they had never experienced a situation where Congress had tried to revitalize terminated judgments and said, you know, that's beyond Congress's ability to do under, because it intrudes into Article III. What I'm suggesting to you here is Congress, to my experience at least, Congress has never before decided to apply a rule that only applies to the facts prospectively and then adopts a different rule. I'm sorry, Judge Randolph.
Congress has done this in the past, and the prime example is the Portal to Portal Act cases.
Say again.
The Portal to Portal Act cases back in the 1940s.
I actually remember the Portal, not from personal experience, but
the Supreme Court ruled one way and said that all of the minors should be paid time and a half, or paid from the moment they entered the mine.
Right.
Not when they hit the wall, the
right.
face. And Congress not only reversed the Supreme Court in the Portal to Portal Act, but it also extinguished all the liability that it accumulated.
Right. Again, so I think the difference there, though, Judge Randolph, is the individual litigation versus across the board, because there were literally thousands of cases at the time of the Portal to Portal Act, and all of those were wiped aside. So everybody was treated exactly the same. The problem with this one is it's only a single dispute that exists that Congress has resolved.
Is it your point that if Congress prescribes or limits a remedy available in a pending litigation, that is a violation of separation of power?
If it doesn't adopt that same rule for prospective adjudication as well, yes.
Well, suppose there is no prospect of further adjudication, whatever the particular issue is.
Well, my guess is that in that situation, it may be similar to the situation with Save Our Malls, which is we don't expect there's going to be litigation. But the reality is, if there can be litigation, the rule that would apply would be the same one that
Congress
had been applied
does that,
retroactively.
Does that, can do that, and did it with some frequency, eliminating, for example, the equitable authority of a court to issue an injunction, or failing to or reinstating sovereign immunity in the middle of a litigation. I mean, that you know, doesn't happen all the time, but it's happened.
Right, but again, typically, I don't know of a single situation that tracks the facts of this one, where you're talking about a single dispute that exists retrospectively, where you assign a rule of decision that finally decides that issues an award, to use the language of Paramino, and then adopt a fundamentally different rule that would not in any way interfere with the rights of the party who has lost retrospectively. It seems to me this is that one step beyond anything that Congress has ever done before, and it is the reason why this violates the separation of powers doctrines, Your Honor. I see my time is up. I hope I have some rebuttal.
Thank you,
Counselor.
You'll have 15 seconds for a vote.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I might award you an extra 45.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Scott McIntosh. I'm with the Department of Justice. In order to prevail on the separation of powers claim that's before the Court today, Exxon has to clear a number of hurdles, and in our view, it doesn't clear any of them, much less all of them. As an initial matter, Klein is a case about interference by Congress in the judicial power of the federal courts under Article III. We're not dealing with an Article III court here. We're dealing with an administrative agency. And Congress and the Supreme Court itself has made clear that there's greater flexibility on the part of Congress to regulate even the adjudicatory actions of federal agencies than there is over federal courts. Getting past that, if one goes beyond it, Exxon has to demonstrate that the nature of the function here is, in fact, judicial in a constitutionally relevant sense. And, of course, this Court's own justification in Exxon for allowing refunds to be awarded by the Commission was that the refund process is functionally prospective, not retrospective. And Exxon can't simultaneously justify the Commission's exercise of refund authority on the theory that it's prospective and then challenge the constitutionality of the statute on the theory that Congress is acting retrospectively. And even if one gets past that, one arrives at National Coalition. And it seems to us that National Coalition, far from helping somehow the case here, really should bring it to a close. This, in our view, this case is very much on all fours with what happened in National Coalition. You have Congress taking on a single pending controversy, changing the rule of decision to be applied in that controversy in a way, indeed in National Coalition, in a way that disposed of the case altogether. Here, of course, Congress's actions in enacting 4412B1 don't dispose of the retroactivity question altogether. They simply place a time limit on it. Now, it's clear that there's no constitutional impediment.
What was the purpose of this legislation?
The legislative history is relatively thin, Your Honor, but to the extent that it's articulated in the legislative history, I think it's simply a concern with the fairness of reaching back the many years that would be involved in this particular proceeding.
What's unfair about that?
I think
one of the parties was getting compensated to an extent that it was not deserved because of the quality of the oil that it was putting in the pipeline. What's unfair about requiring them to cough up that money?
Well, Your Honor, because there are offsetting or countervailing reliance interests, or at least Congress could so determine. Remember that from 1993 to 1995, when this case was originally on appeal in the Oxy litigation, the Oxy phase, shippers could well have assumed that the rates chosen, the valuation chosen by the Commission or approved by the Commission would be sustained on appeal. So too from 97 to 99 during the Exxon phase, they could have likewise assumed that the remand valuation would have been sustained. And even in the intermediate period from 95 to 97 when it was on remand, shippers could have assumed that any changes made by the Commission would be given prospective effect, as indeed the Commission did in 97. So from 93 all the way to this Court's decision in July of 99 in Exxon, Congress could reasonably think that shippers were relying on the rates that they were actually paying and not relying on the risk that the rates might be changed in a retroactive way. And it's perfectly legitimate for Congress under those circumstances to try to protect those reliance interests. As a matter of policy, Congress can make the judgment that those kinds of interests are entitled to protection. That's certainly not a separation of powers problem, and neither is an equal protection problem. There's a rational basis for Congress to draw the kind of line it drew. There's a rational basis for Congress to distinguish between this pending proceeding and future proceedings. Of course, in all future proceedings, the rule established by this Court in Exxon, you know, in terms of a presumption of retroactivity, will be known. But until 99, that wasn't known to the parties. That was a decision made by this Court at that time. And so the reliance interest changed. The line that Congress drew, the statutory line that Congress drew, or the date that it chose, February of 2000, is very close to the date of this Court's own opinion in Exxon. Are they the same? No, but they're pretty close. And that's certainly close enough for an equal protection rational basis review. If the Court has no questions.
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Not to forget the intervener. Excuse me. Go ahead, sir.
Morning, Your Honors. Theodore Boutrous representing the interveners defending the constitutionality of the statute. I think it's very compelling that Mr. Phillips' strongest case is the Paramino Lumber case, because in that case, the Congress overturned it, and then the Court distinguished the cases on judicial power, saying that the cases cited by appellants on the question of the invasion of judicial authority involve statutes affecting judicial judgments rather than administrative orders and are therefore inapplicable. And so I think it's the Supreme Court has, and this Court have interpreted Klein very narrowly, not even close to the situation we have here. And in fact, in Plaut, it was a very similar situation where the Supreme Court held that the statute of limitations in 10b-5 actions was going to be much shorter, cutting off liability against a relatively narrow class of defendants. Congress overturned that in those pending cases and dictated that a longer limitations rule apply, and the Supreme Court said that that wasn't a Klein problem, it was a separate problem regarding final judgments. So I think that this is not even a close question on separation of powers at all. Regarding the reliance interest that Judge Randolph asked about, we had a unique situation here, Your Honor, in the sense that Congress would have been entitled to determine that it was impossible to unscramble the egg, that it was impossible to put the parties back to where they were would have been in 1993 if they had known the value of the quality bank assessments. And there was no way for the refiners or anyone to know that the value would be what was ultimately determined by the ALJ here. And for the refiners, it's a very important factor. Beginning at page 1257 of the Joint Appendix is the argument made by the refiners to the commission or the as to why, had they known what the assessment would be, they would adjust and optimize their business operations to minimize those quality bank assessments. ConocoPhillips, one of the companies on the other side here, had a witness testify about how the refiners, when they know what the assessments are going to be, can make decisions to reduce those payments. And so it's not at all clear that Exxon and ConocoPhillips would have received more or how much more they would have received, or that the refiners would have had to pay more. And so Congress was entitled to come up with a compromise. It didn't direct that the commission decide no retroactivity or complete retroactivity to 2000. It simply said there's a time limit, much like a statute of limitations, which is a classic legislative compromise. And so I think for all those reasons, this is clearly a rational decision by Congress. And finally, I think Mr. Phillips' argument boils down to the fact that there was a limited group or a singling out of one group or two companies. But the Supreme Court in Plaut said very clearly, even laws that impose a duty or liability upon a single individual or firm are not on that account invalid. This court made the same point in Save Our Mall, and I think those cases are dispositive. Thank you.
Yes. We'll give you a whole minute for rebuttal,
Mr. Phillips. Try to give you back some portion of it, Chief Judge Santel. I mean, I just want to make three points. First of all, with respect to the question that Judge Randolph asked about what was the policy here and the question of unfairness, it's interesting that the only argument they make is reliance. Reliance is a classic adjudicatory issue, and indeed the reliance interests of these parties were in fact adjudicated specifically by the ALJ and with the period after the statute went into effect. In fact, the FERC itself found there were no legitimate reliance interests here. It just demonstrates that this is an adjudicatory, this is a judicial function. This is not a legislative function. The only policy that undergirds this is the policy of robbing Peter to pay Paul, which I think is not a legitimate legislative objection.
That's Congress, the tax law. What do you mean?
And that's fine. And if they had done this through tax, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that they must have run out of earmark money by the time they got to this provision, because after they built the bridge to nowhere, at this point they just took it from us.
You've never run out of earmark.
I feel as though there was just a slight dip there. And then finally, with respect, it's interesting that they criticized me for relying on Save Our Malls, which went the other way, when they rely on Plaut, which of course itself went the other way on the separation of powers argument. But the bottom line here is, and what distinguishes this case, of course Congress can deal with a class of one if it has to. What it cannot do is deal with a class of one, treat it adversely, and adopt a rule prospectively when the class is all carriers, not simply those who've used this in the past, and use a different rule in that context, Your Honor.
I gave you a minute and 31 seconds there.
I appreciate
so
Your Honor.
Your
thank
time
you.
Is up, and we'll proceed to the next issue.
May it please the Court, Stephen Kinnaird for ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. Issue 2B concerns the valuation of the naphtha and vacuum gas oil or VGO, produced from coking the Brazil for the period October 2002 to 2005. And the commission held that it would apply the new prospective rates for straight run naphtha and VGO rather than the existing rates that were in effect during the relevant time period. That was error, and it contravenes the essential design of the RSID methodology and distorts the relative valuation of the different cuts. And the key reason is that the quality bank uses, for all coker and straight run products, the same reference prices, precisely because the quality bank refinery that the commission modeled generates the exact same products.
That's not true of the coker, is it? I thought that had to be refined further.
It had to be refined. We're talking about the final products. So the RSID is valued by nine refined products. Seven of them are the exact same products that come out of the initial distillation. So the commission's rate design is that it takes the same quality bank reference prices for the straight run products and simply plugs it in to the corresponding product for the RSID. And that's how it's done for all of the straight run and coker products, even for naphtha and VGO, except for this three-year hiatus where the commission has ordered different rates to be applied.
Is this VGO and naphtha, is that a manufactured, is that stuff manufactured as a result of the processing of the RSID after the what you call straight line is taken out?
Yes, it is one of the products. It comes out at first from the initial distillation, but then when you coke the RSID, naphtha and VGO are one of the products
from coking. It's a manufacturing process.
Yes, it comes it from the coking. And then the key.
You get some of it in the first cutting process.
Yes,
and then
that's
you
right.
Get some more of it when you take the RSID and do the coking.
Right. And why is it that the rate design requires the same prices for straight run and coker? Well, the reason is that the quality bank refinery is designed to process the coker, VGO, and naphtha to make it the exact same product as the straight run naphtha. And this can be found in O'Brien's testimony at JA 1546 to 1551 and the charge PAI 13 to 15. And what he's discussing there are the costs of hydrotreating the VGO and naphtha so it meets the exact same quality specs as the straight run VGO and naphtha, and therefore that it can trade at the exact same quality bank reference price. And using the same reference price for straight run and coker products is the linchpin of the RSID methodology. Because what that means is that when the market prices fluctuate over time, there will be always a direct relationship between the straight run values and between the coker values, or the RSID, and separated only by the processing cost adjustment. And this ensures fair compensation and that the valuations of the different cuts move in tandem. And the fundamental flaw of the commission's methodology is it breaks that relationship. The formula doesn't work properly to keep accurate relative valuation. And this court in Oxy and again in Exxon has emphasized that the enterprise of the quality bank is to ensure relative valuation accuracy. And that is lost because what the commission is doing is introducing systematic bias in favor of the RSID cut. Because on the same day, for the same product, they are using a high coker naphtha price to value the RSID cut and then a low coker naphtha price to value the straight run VGO and naphtha. And that means that you have systematic bias in favor of shippers like the refiners who have very little straight run naphtha but a heavy quotient of RSID. And finally, it is just fundamentally arbitrary and capricious for the exact same VGO and naphtha product, which has the exact same quality specs, comes out of the same refinery, is combined together in the same hydrotreater, ends up in the same final storage tanks, and is sold on the same date. And for the commission to say, on that same date, that exact same product has a different market price. The commission's reasoning is unsound.
Isn't the commission's answer to that that they're using it for a different purpose, namely to value RSID?
Well, the purpose of the quality bank is to ensure, as this court emphasized in Oxy,
what's the answer to my question? That's the commission's answer, isn't it?
That's not a, you know, that's a different subprocess, but it's not a different purpose. The purpose is overall reasonable valuation. So it doesn't matter.
The commission says the purpose here is different.
Well, but that's simply contrary to its design. What you're trying to do is you're trying to value the resid according to the same straight run products so that you have an overall valuation of the resid and the other products that move in line. And since the design of the Quality Bank refinery is to make the refined products exactly the same, same sulfur content, so that they trade on the same price. So you can't have them different. So the purpose is, there is no separate purpose in that regard. And the commission also misreads the, I see my time is up.
Time is up. We will hear from the commission.
Thank you.
Ms. Patel.
Good morning again, Your Honors. As Judge Tatel was just pointing out, the commission did explain that the Coker, NAPTA, and VGO valuations are a portion of the resid cut valuation. And in addressing what the just and reasonable resid cut valuation would be here, the commission found that it needed to use Coker and NAPTA, Coker, VGO, and NAPTA valuations that were just and reasonable. And so because the resid valuation had never been found to be just and reasonable by this court, this court has sent it back always since 1993. There has never been a just and reasonable resid value. The commission was required to put in place a just and reasonable value. The commission could not do so if it used a not just and reasonable NAPTA value, which, again, the commission has found that the pre-existing NAPTA value was no longer just and reasonable. And again, as petitioners pointed out, this is a locked-in period. So this isn't something that's going on forward. This is, again, for resid in the past. In the future, the new values apply in any event. So this doesn't continue on. This was raised on rehearing, pointing out two things, that if Coker, VGO, and NAPTA were not used, the resulting resid valuation would be unjust and reasonable and would violate Oxy's consistency requirement as well. There are no questions from the court. Thank you very much.
Call the next issue.
Issue 3, NAPTA cut timing issue. For the petitioner, Mr. Jones, for the respondents, Ms. Pastrana.
Good morning again, Your Honors. On this one, first address, I think the commission states that the petitioners are wrong in saying that there was no other averaging on the NAPTA, and it likened it to the Coker feedstock averaging for the resid. However, the difference is in those Coker products, you're still taking the Quality Bank cut product that came from a single published price and putting it into that formula. We're talking about a locked-in period here from August 17, 2003 to October 31, 2005. That's the time period that this applies. And this is a different methodology. Averaging very simply, before that NAPTA, you took a published price, and that was your cut value for that month. What happened here, they want to take a new cargo tariff came out, a new published price, average it. So you have two steps. You have to add two, divide by two, and you come up with the value. So obviously, you have some mathematical steps. But there's an important part in here is the cargo lots were 250,000 barrels, barge lots, 50,000 barrels. And I think it's a generally accepted economic principle and marketing principle that it costs more to buy small lots than if you buy in bulk. In the case exactly what happened here, the price of the barge quote was 1 cent higher. So when you average, it's a half cent. That increased the price by 0.5 cent. I guess if you wanted to say it was like the Coker, you would weight average. 5/6 of it would have been the cargo and 1/6 the barge. But if you got to that point, I'm not sure you gained much weight averaging. The impact, and I think it's clear, and I think from the Tesoro versus FERC case that Judges Randolph and Tatel, you both were on, it was clear at the time when Tesoro came in, ANS was only going to the West Coast. And they were coming in trying to get West Coast values for NAPTA and VGO. So at the time this averaging went in, this methodology, it was clear, everybody understood, it was designed only for West Coast NAPTA. And in effect, the new methodology to increase the cost of West Coast naphtha. Therefore, if it goes forward, and under the stipulation of the parties, if there's a new methodology for West Coast naphtha, then the new VGO price that was stipulated to was to go in effect on the same date. So to just state, our position is very clear, if the commission is going to average and use a new methodology, because that also opens up Pandora's box, if you will. Everybody knows there's more than one price for VGO, heavy disc, or jet fuel, diesel, all of these products that are used in the quality bank. You could go out and find waterborne pipelines, start averaging. But if they want to go down that path, and if they're going to have averaging in a new methodology, then under the stipulation of the parties, the new VGO price should be effective August 17, 2003. Thank you. Unless you have any questions, Your Honor, I'm done.
Seeing none, we'll hear from the government.
I don't know if the court has any specific questions on this issue.
Any questions? Not then. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear the next issue.
Issue 4, VGO and NAPSA effective date issues for the petitioner, Mr. Carr, for the respondents, Ms. Pincella.
Can you tell me, I meant to ask, I don't know who to ask this question, is Tessura a party here?
I believe it is not a petitioner on this issue, no.
Well,
and it did not file.
I mean, you're going to talk about the dismissal of their complaint, but
right.
I don't see in any of the briefs anybody counsel for Tessura in any of these briefs. So I don't know.
Is anyone within the well purport to
speak? Would you like to speak up?
Hearing none.
Yeah, I don't think they're representative, but go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Bart O'Farr, and I'm representing Flint Hills and PetroStar. And the final question this morning before the court is whether the commission, when it adopted new values for West Coast VGO and NAPSA, should have made those values effective at a date prior to its October 2005 order. And we think that it should have, for the primary reason that an earlier effective date is needed in order to put the parties in the position they would have been in if the commission hadn't erroneously dismissed the Tesoro complaint.
Are you aware of any case since Tennessee Valley where this court has done that?
Well, if we're talking about the general principle,
do you know of any case where the Tennessee Valley principle, whatever it is, has been applied to impose a retroactive rate, notwithstanding the filed rate doctrine?
If the Tennessee Valley principle is regarded, as I regard it, as being the principle that puts the parties in the position they would be in absent commission error, there are a number of cases, yes.
With retroactive rates?
Pardon me?
Retroactive rates?
Yes. I mean, in terms of, if we mean by the term retroactive, a rate that is deemed to go into effect before the date of the agency order that approves it, for example, Consumers Council is a case.
Where there was a filed rate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Consumer Council is a practice case rather than a rate case, but it's a Section 5 case. There was a pre-existing practice that the commission ultimately held to be unreasonable. It did not at that point, however, issue an order setting aside that practice. And when the Court of Appeals said that it should have at that time and that any later order that it issued should take the date of the time when it should have issued the correct order in the first place. I think that's all that we're talking about here is the basic idea that when a commission makes an error, and there are different kinds of errors, obviously, but whenever it makes an error, that the kind of remedy that it should implement is one that in time goes back to when it should have made the correct decision.
And what's left of the file rate doctrine?
Well, where you have legal error.
So any time the commission makes an error, the new rate can be retroactive, even though the previous rate was just and reasonable?
Well, the fact is that when you what you have is essentially, in some cases, you have the error that the commission makes is holding that the prior rate was just and reasonable when it isn't, and that therefore the new rate can be put into place when it should have made the correct finding in the first place. But in this case, the error that it makes is simply one of delay. Here, there is a new rate put into place. It seems to me that's the critical point with respect to Tennessee Valley, not whether the prior rate is...
Well, you can always argue there's a delay in any commission decision.
Well, Judge Taylor, I think you're making a good point, but the point in Tennessee Valley, it seems to me, is to separate the usual delay in commission proceedings, the delay that's needed in order to resolve a complaint, and the additional delay, which is caused by a commission error that sets the process running for an even longer time.
But it does seem odd that you're making that argument when you're at least one of your clients and the successor to the corporation are the ones that asked the commission to make that error.
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, just as a factual basis, I would dispute that we're a successor other than in the sense that we just bought the refinery, not a legal successor. But if I may address the estoppel point.
But you did adopt all of William's arguments when you intervened.
That is, I think, not entirely accurate,
no?
Judge Tatel. What the motion said is that pending the initial determination that Flint Hills would not add to the record and it would rely on the filings by Williams. I'm not sure that's exactly the same thing as saying that after the initial determination that it would still make the same arguments that Williams had made. And of course, Williams remained in the case and made their own arguments afterwards. So I think, but also on the estoppel point, Judge Randolph, I think the first point to be made about that was not a basis for the commission's order below, and therefore I don't think it's a proper basis
That's true enough.
This court.
While we're on that, one thing I can't find is the commission did discuss Tennessee Valley in its initial opinion.
Correct.
It doesn't appear to have discussed it in the opinion on rehearing.
It did not. There were none of the rehearings.
So the question I have is whether William, at the time it was Williams, right, and Petrostar, in fact, filed petitions for rehearing raising Tennessee Valley.
None of the petitions for rehearing raised Tennessee Valley.
Well, then aren't you stopped from raising it in this court? Unless you ask for rehearing, my understanding for 18 years of FERC law is that you have to ask for rehearing on a particular issue, and if you don't, then you can't raise it.
Your Honor, I think that's not correct under the Interstate Commerce Act. That's correct under some of the other statutes, but I believe it's in the previous decision in Oxy, the court said that it was not required to file a rehearing petition in Interstate Commerce.
Let me go back. I just want to ask you about your answer Judge Randolph's first question. You said the commission didn't rely on equitable estoppel, right?
Correct.
But why would it have? Exxon had properly raised the Tennessee Valley issue, hadn't it?
That's correct.
So the commission had to decide that question.
Well, it did have to decide the question.
Why would it have? There was no need for the commission to address equitable estoppel.
Well, whether there was a need for it to do or not, Judge Tatel, it didn't.
But there was no need for it to. So why is it of any significance that they didn't raise equitable estoppel? They had to decide the question.
Well, I think it's of significance because I don't think this court can uphold the commission's order on a basis that was not in the commission's order. I think that's basic Chenery principle.
Isn't there another answer to Judge Tatel's question, which is a good one and bothered me, is the fact that Petrostar and I think it was Williams adopted Exxon's Tennessee Valley argument. So, yeah, you wouldn't raise estoppel against Exxon, but to the extent that the other two other parties, the ones you represent now, raised it by adopting Exxon's objection, then it did present itself.
Well, let me try to make it as clear as I can. Our position here with respect to estoppel is that the commission did not address estoppel, and therefore it is not a proper basis for upholding the commission's order, regardless of the reason that the commission didn't. It could have addressed the estoppel issue, but it did not. The second point, though, that I would like to make, is which I think is related to that, is it's particularly important that they didn't, because if you apply the Commission's own standards for estoppel, it seems to me very unlikely that they could have found estoppel here. As far as equitable estoppel goes, they apply the basic five-part test, which requires a false representation and detrimental reliance. You don't get a false representation with legal arguments. That doesn't fit the typical description. And with detrimental reliance, you had parties on both sides of this issue.
I think that maybe the word estoppel is not the right word. I know that FERC used it in its brief, and I don't think that's really an accurate description. It's that the description is there's no unfairness under Tennessee Valley in refusing to put a party back in the position it would have occupied when that party is the one that caused the error, or at least possibly responsible. I don't know what you call it, estoppel or what, or a modification to Tennessee Valley. But
I think there are two things there, Judge Randall. First of all, you know, that is in a sense what is thought of as to be judicial estoppel, where you penalize a party for changing positions in the course of litigation. But the Commission's principle with respect to judicial estoppel is basically there is almost no judicial estoppel before the Commission. They apply it only in a very narrow circumstance where there is testimony that is relied on. And they just repeated that last year in the Louisiana Public Service case. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that there were parties on both sides now that opposed the Tesoro complaint. Among the interveners here are people who oppose the Tesoro complaint. So the question is, with parties on both sides, do you put everybody back in the position they would have been without the error, or do you leave the error in place? And it seems to me that given the choice between those with parties on both sides, that one would follow the traditional remedial principle that the court has applied and indeed invoked in earlier proceedings in this case in the Exxon opinion. I see my time is up. May I have additional time for rebuttal? Thank you.
We'll see if we need any rebuttal time. If she gets up and says she has nothing to say, you won't get to rebuttal.
I think I should talk about this for a couple of minutes. The NAPFA and VGO cuts are quite different from the RESID cut valuation in that there were approved, just and reasonable, lawful NAPFA and VGO rates in effect at the time that this case came about. So the Commission, respecting the filed rate doctrine, understood that it could not apply the new valuations retroactively.
Is there a tension between Tennessee Valley and the filed rate doctrine?
I think that Tennessee Valley, clearly there is a tension between them, and I think that as Judge Tatel's question was a good one, that has there ever been a case that's applied it? I liked it too. Has that ever been that principle of that seems to come out of Tennessee Valley, has that ever been applied again? And no, I mean, Tennessee Valley has always been interpreted to be when the Commission commits legal error, the proper remedy is to put people, to make parties whole, but that isn't in a circumstance where it would violate the filed rate doctrine to do so, which it certainly would do that here. I'll spend a minute on the equitable estoppel, if I could. Both Flint Hills and PetroStar previously argued to the Commission successfully that refunds should not be ordered regarding these valuations because of Tennessee Valley. And they've never come into the Commission at any point and said, wow, yeah, we previously said that, but now we realize that we were wrong about that, and we take that back, and we ask you now to order refunds for that. The first time they're doing that is here in court, where they're coming actually and speaking to the Tennessee value issue. And if there's no further questions.
Are you sure about that? I thought they adopted Exxon's.
They did adopt Exxon's thing, but it did not speak to it just argued. It made the they did adopt Exxon's rehearing request, Exxon's exceptions, which they adopted and the Commission answered, but they never came in and said. Let me see.
Yeah, Flint Hill hereby adopts. This is on page 1309.
Right, they do adopt that.
1309.
And then
hereby adopts the following exceptions and arguments thereof filed by Exxon and ConocoPhillips. The ALJ erred in not making the effective date for West Coast's NAPFA value retroactive to at least March 1st, 2003.
And it's possible that I'm wrong about that point. So maybe I'll turn, and I don't think I am. I think I had an argument that I'm just not being clear on now. So I'm not conceding that. On the other hand, I can't argue otherwise at this moment. But if you look at the merits of the Commission's discussion regarding Tennessee Valley, I think you'll see that the Commission was correct, that it could not, in this circumstance, Tennessee Valley doesn't apply regarding.
So in Tennessee Valley, was there not a just and reasonable rate in place?
In Tennessee Valley?
Right.
There was.
There was, wasn't there?
In there was a just and reasonable value
so
in place in Tennessee
Valley.
That's
not the basis for distinguishing Tennessee Valley here.
No, the basis for distinguishing Tennessee Valley is regarding the. What the Commission distinguished Tennessee Valley based on wasn't that. It was based on the fact that it eventually found the rate to be unjust and reasonable when it actually looked at the complaint. And regarding the VGO cut, that did not occur here. The Commission has never made a merits finding regarding the VGO cut. So that rate has never been found. The prior rate has never been found to be unjust and unreasonable.
I don't understand the Commission's distinction of Tennessee Valley, at least part of it. The difference is that in Tennessee Valley, the Commission itself reversed itself.
No, that's not at all what the Commission was saying,
Honor. But in case, it's the court that reversed the Commission.
No, no. The Commission didn't say that. What the Commission said is.
How do you read this on page JA1377?
The Commission was just.
In this case, the Commission did not reverse itself, but rather the court directed the Commission to.
And you need to continue on. All the Commission is explaining is the background of the scenario. The Commission then goes on to explain, quote, there has been no merits order on the VGO cut. And that, again, is at 481 JA, in 481 at JA1377 to 78, paragraph 174.
That's what I just read to you.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. The next sentence talks about there has never been a merits order. If you look again,
what do we do with Mr. Farr's argument that we can't uphold the Commission on a basis that the Commission said nothing in here about what you call a stop, right? So how under Chenery, how do we uphold the Commission on that? Well, there is an exception.
There's an exception
to Chenery, which is that. That we've adopted in this court from time to time, which is we don't send a case back to an agency when it's clear to us that the agency is what the agency is going to do with it. We can still uphold.
That's true, but I would say even
and you
more
haven't
than
broke that.
That
doctrine either.
To me, this is more like prudential standing. So while it's not jurisdictional in the sense that constitutional standing is, it's a court doctrine. This estoppel is a court doctrine. I'm saying that they're stopped from raising it in this court.
So you're
and I'm relying
us
on
to exercise, I see. Right.
I'm asking you to exercise
this court.
It. Exactly.
Because they didn't raise it before the Commission.
Because not that they didn't raise it before the Commission, but that they argued the opposite. My understanding of this record, Judge Randolph, and I wish I had written that page down, is that the Exxon argument doesn't say you shouldn't reverse for it wasn't sufficient to bring before this court in circumstances where at the time of the complaint, when the Commission kicked this complaint, and it was argued to the Commission that Tennessee Valley required it not to kick the complaint, they argued that that's wrong and that cannot be overcome. In light of Consolidated Rail, for example, which I've cited to the court, that says that equitable estoppel, or whatever we want to call it here today, whatever's the more appropriate thing, precludes a litigant from asserting an otherwise available claim against a party who has detrimentally relied on the litigant's conduct. The Commission denied the claim based on Tennessee Valley when it was looking at the Tesoro complaint because Flint Hills came in and told the Commission to do that. And now they're coming back and saying, whoa. Years later, they're saying we were wrong about that. Well, that's just too little too late. They didn't argue you should reinstate it now. Please reverse on Tennessee Valley grounds and give those refunds on that basis.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I get the sense I should give you a minute back for rebuttal, counsel. So reluctantly, I'll give you another minute.
Thank you, Chief Judge Santel. I have two things that I'd like to do with my rebuttal time, if I may. First of all, I'd just like to make the point that the discussion about estoppel here points up, it seems to me, very clearly why this court typically does not try to uphold commission orders on grounds that the commission has not itself put in the order. Aside from keeping the proper separation between agency and court, it allows a proper record to be built, a factual record. Here, it's completely inaccurate to say that there was a Tennessee Valley argument before the court when the question of dismissing the Tesoro, before the commission, when the question of dismissing the Tesoro complaint was before it. Obviously, Tennessee Valley is a remedial issue that only comes up after the dismissal, after the reversal by this court and the remand and the reinstatement of the complaint. So Tennessee Valley was not in the case at all until all of those things had happened. Now, the one other thing I would like to do is try to address again Judge Tatel's point about what seems to be the oddity of Tennessee Valley. Right. All I'm suggesting about Tennessee Valley is that the principle that it applies is a well-recognized, familiar one that this court applies in numerous situations, which has put the parties back in the position they would have been in if an agency hadn't committed error. Sometimes that means moving the effective date of the eventual correct commission order back to an earlier time when it would have been issued if there hadn't been error. The only thing that makes this confusing at all, and the reason the Tennessee Valley seems more novel than it actually is because you have to understand that the Tennessee Valley Court went to great lengths to not make the effective date overly retroactive. What the court did was it said there is a certain period of time it takes to decide whether to hear the complaint or dismiss it. That's proper time. Then there's the time after the erroneous dismissal before the complaint is reinstated. That's improper time. Then once the complaint is reinstated, there is the time it takes to render a final decision. That is proper time. So of the three time periods, only the middle one is taken out, and that is, you know, it makes it arithmetically more complex, but otherwise it's basically the same principle.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, you've exhausted your time again, and we'll take recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned.